Recovering from the Storm, Advice for Homeowners. As crews continue to work on restoring power to thousands of Mainers, the process of cleaning up, repairing, and restoring damaged property is also underway. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Main Calling, we'll find out the latest on the recovery effort from emergency responders and the utilities. We'll talk with professional contractors and an electrician about how to safely and properly fix any storm damage done to your property. We'll also check in with an insurance expert about making sure you get the most out of your homeowner's coverage. We'll also get advice on the safe use of chainsaws and on protecting your family against carbon monoxide poisoning and food poisoning when the power goes out. And as always, we want to hear from you. Tell us your story. Recovering from a storm that's now been determined to have caused more outages in Maine than the ice storm of 1998. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The storm that struck Maine last Sunday will be remembered for a long time. Today we're going to get an update on recovery efforts and get some answers to your questions about recovering from this event. On the line with us is Susan Falloon. She's a public information officer with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
With us for the hour is Ian Robertson. He's owner of New Leaf Construction. Welcome, Ian. And in the studio with me is Tom Hedstrom. He's founder of Hedstrom Electric, a family-owned and operated company located in Camden. During today's show, we'll hear from the Maine Red Cross, the Maine Insurance Bureau, as well as the state toxicologist. And, of course, as always, we want to hear from you. Send us your questions about storm recovery. Send them to us early so we can get to them. Our email address is talk@mainepublic.org. You can also send us a tweet, post to the Maine Calling Facebook page, or give us a call. But a warning, we too have been affected by the storm, so our phones are acting up a little bit, but you can give it a try. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I do want to go first to Gail Rice with Central Maine Power. Gail, are you with us? Gail, can you hear me?
I think it's subsumed under a much broader
umbrella. Okay, we'll try one more time. Gail Rice. Hi, Gail. Can you hear me? Well, as I warned you at the top, the phones are a little dicey. We'll see if we can get to Gail. Let me try Susan Falloon. Susan, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. We'll start with you while we try to see if we can find out what's up with Gail's line there. What can you tell us from the Maine Emergency Management Agency about what you're hearing, what the lingering issues are here in a few days after the recovery effort has started?
Well, what we're starting to hear a lot right now is people looking for assistance. And so I just want to let people know that there are some limited resources out there. The state is pursuing a federal disaster declaration for public assistance, and local municipalities are collecting that information for public infrastructure. When it comes to individual assistance, it's too early to tell at this point. We've had a lot of folks asking if FEMA is going to help pay for damage or lost food, those kinds of things. That is something that we are working on. It's not an overnight thing that just happened. So there is a process, and we're working through that process. But meanwhile, there are some options out there. So if somebody did lose a lot of food, first of all, we want people to document any and all losses, take pictures, save receipts, keep information on estimates. We don't want people to wait on repairing that leaky roof or to stay in an unsafe situation because they're waiting to get news or of some assistance. But what we are asking them to do is take a picture of that tree before you remove it from your house or car. And save all of your receipts. The first thing that you should do is contact your homeowner's insurance, and all policies are different, and I'm certainly not the expert on insurance, but that would be the first place to start. people who cannot afford to replace their food or make other repairs, they may be able to get some assistance through their municipal general fund. When it comes to food, we do have a number of shelters open. So if somebody needs food, you know, they need a meal today, they should contact their municipalities to find out where the local shelters and warming centers are and if they can get food there. We do have that information up on our website as well, and that is maine.gov/MEMA, and it's also on our Facebook page and Twitter, and that information is available by calling 211.
Okay, and so... sorry to interrupt, but so there is financial assistance available if this be if this is an emergency, though. As you mentioned, people could take photographs of damage or things that they had to fix. Might they be able to be eligible for some type of federal disaster fund?
Well, like I said, we're working through that process. There is absolutely no guarantee that that is going to materialize, and we want to make that clear. So we want people to start pursuing other options, and we will widely publicize if individual assistance does become available. But that is not something that happens overnight. It could be a week, even 2 weeks. So people obviously can't wait that long to replace their food supply and discard food that has been spoiled. So that's why documentation is absolutely key at this point. But I do want to, we don't want to set any expectations that there will be individual assistance and that people will be reimbursed for their losses. We will certainly do what we can to make that request. And that is a long process. It involves gathering a lot of documentation.
Sure. Let's see if we can bring Gail Rice in. Gail, I'm going to try and see if we can get you on the line here. Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. You are with us.
Yay.
Okay. Thank you, Gail. Gail, first, what's the latest on the restoration effort in terms of customers?
At about midday today, our total customers without power is about 120,000, and that's down from 404,000 at midday on Monday. We expect to complete restoration to the majority of customers by late Saturday evening. But, you know, that doesn't mean everybody waits till Saturday evening. What it means is we'll be making restoration progress over time, and most people will get their power back before that.
We've had a few comments already before the show saying, hey, why is the website saying one thing it doesn't match the experience that's going on. What would you say to people who are monitoring the website closely for information about specifics of where power is coming back and when?
We actually have a team of employees devoted to updating those web listings by town and road today with more site-specific information. We do want people to understand, you know, we've had some technical problems with that site. However, we are working on that. But we want people to know that if their street drops off that list, that does not mean that we think they're back on. We have other sources of data that we use to determine where the power is out, and we know their power is out, and we will be working on it.
We've had a few comments. I know this comes up every time there is a major storm, but I am getting some comments from people asking, hey, why do we have such an antiquated system? Why don't we bury cables underground? I know this has been addressed, that it's incredibly expensive to bury cables, but I did hear from a couple of acquaintances that in some neighborhoods in Portland, for example, some cables are buried underground. How many neighborhoods or how much buried cable is there in your service area, and why are they buried, and who pays for that?
I don't have any figures on how many miles of cable are buried, but I can tell you that if a developer wants underground utilities in a neighborhood that it is under construction, that developer pays the incremental cost for that undergrounding, and that would be the cost difference between the very costly undergrounding instead of the standard overhead installation. So those people with underground lines, their developer paid for that. And this way, the rest of CMP's customers who have regular roadside distribution lines overhead do not have to pay for one neighborhood's more costly service. So it's the developer of those neighborhoods who pays for those underground utilities.
I was at a press conference yesterday with the governor and Sarah Burns, president of CMP, And she explained that there is an effort going on to come up with ways to mitigate the impact of such storms, short of burying lines. But technology or even basic things like using thicker utility poles that are less apt to snap. Can you sort of tell people about that effort and what are some of the things that are being considered?
Yeah, we are starting to install thicker, more robust utility poles in areas considered vulnerable to severe weather. And in some places, we have also tried on a trial basis replacing the traditional wooden poles with poles made of composite materials. And we're going to watch those and see how they stand up to main weather. Also, we have a five-year distribution line inspection and preventative maintenance program that goes on across our service area. And when distribution line, these are the roadside overhead lines you see along streets and roads across our service area, when that distribution line is due to be replaced, we're starting to use more resilient lines with coatings on them, kind of a poly coating that makes those lines less sensitive to incidental tree contact. And there are a couple different grades of this coated line depending on the location and the proximity of trees. And the other things we have going for us today that we didn't have 20 years ago is new technology such as substation and distribution automation equipment. And in addition to that, our smart meter system. Those systems help us to be more efficient when we're restoring power following a storm. So perhaps the duration of that outage would be shorter.
We got a note on social media about tree trimming, and the person said, "Hey, I used to see CMP doing all this tree trimming. I haven't seen that lately. Is that inaccurate, or have you been doing tree trimming?"
We adopted a five-year cycle for tree pruning in 2007-2008, and that cycle is still in place. We trim about 20% of our distribution system every year, so that is ongoing. That person might be towards the end of that cycle and might be seeing crews in his or her neighborhood soon. But that five-year cycle on tree pruning is still in place.
All right, Gail, I know you're busy today. Appreciate you coming in and keep up the good work. Thanks
so
very
great
much.
Talking to you, Keith.
Gail Rice, a spokesperson for CMP. Let's go. Now, I promised to get to my other guests here, but we want to bring in now Caroline King, who is with us, the Executive Director of Northern and Eastern Maine Chapter of the Red Cross. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Welcome.
Can you give us a sense of how Red Cross is responding to the storm in terms of the services that you've been providing and what has been most in need?
Yes. Well, thank you for having us. We are continuing to provide emergency sheltering for people who continue to be without power in their homes. We have sites across the state. We currently have three shelters open across the state, and as well as a number of warming centers that are operated by different county officials. Those sites include things like warm showers, cots, meals, snacks, and basic services for folks to charge their cell phones or their computers, and are available 24 hours a day for folks.
You have a shelter in Orono. Is that still open?
The shelter in Orono is no longer open. Overnight, we did have shelter in Old Town as well as in Brewer. Both of those sites, though, have closed because most of those communities and those individuals' power has been restored.
So do you have any advice, then, for people who are still without and struggling from the effects of that? Where can they turn for help?
Sure. They can first and foremost call 211. That will get them access to information and resources in their local area, obviously. We're reaching out to folks in all of the traditional media, but if folks are having trouble watching their regular news or what have you, they can reach out directly to 211. We do advise people to be very careful and very cautious around, of course, down power lines. If they are still without power, they should not be utilizing any of their food that's in their refrigerator. Just based on the duration of the disaster, that food is probably not safe to be eaten. So we do encourage folks to reach out to us or to their local county if they're still without power and still struggling.
Caroline King, Executive Director of Northern and Eastern Maine Chapter of the Red Cross, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Caroline, Tom Hedstrom mentioned down power lines. Is that one of the things that electricians such as yourself are getting calls from now for people?
Absolutely. Thank you, Keith. We are receiving many calls for service entrances that have been taken down off the sides of homes, mostly by falling trees.
Yeah, and so what are some of the other big things that people are – I assume that maybe they bought a generator, they were impatient, bought a generator, and now it's time to hook it up. Is
True.
That something the average person can just do, or do they need an electrician?
No, you do need an electrician to hook up a generator, tie it into your circuit breaker panel. What we use there is a transfer switch. There's two different types of transfer switch. There's a manual transfer switch that we use with a gasoline generator. And those, you know, that's it's a little more work to use those. Obviously, you know, rolling the generator out. And
I'm just curious, how much does it cost on average to install a generator?
A manual?
Apart from the cost of the generator itself.
Sure. Well, usually when you buy an automatic transfer switch, the generator comes with it. So I'd say for a manual transfer switch with a gasoline generator, you should budget $1,500, maybe $2,000.
Yeah, so no small expense.
Just true, and for an automatic with a propane generator, maybe $6,000 to $12,000, depending on your conditions.
Okay, and we'll take more questions about that. Before the break, I want to bring in Ian Robertson, also of New Leaf Construction. Hi, Ian. Can you hear me?
I can, Keith. How are you?
Good, thanks. Welcome to the show. We are up against a break, but I did want to bring you in and say, what kind of calls are you getting from people? Is it mostly about damage done by branches or wind, or what are you getting?
I feel like it's a mix. Certainly the vast majority of it is damage from trees, both to roofing, to windows or siding, and like Tom is seeing, power lines being ripped off the house and damage being done to the side of the house as those lines are torn out from their fasteners. But we're also seeing flooded basements as well.
And these aren't the kinds of things that you do all the time, right? These are the kinds of repairs that only come along once in a while with a storm. But are you prepared to deal with them? Do they have special, issues with them in terms of how they need to be done?
Really, the only challenge is when the power lines are involved. So obviously, you know, we've all seen the CMP commercials where no line is safe to touch ever. But when we arrive and there's a tree leaning on the house and it's wrapped up with the wires, you know, there's a difficulty telling whether power is present. If it's clear the lines have been ripped free from the poles and they're completely disconnected, we have a little bit more comfort in trying to get the tree off the house and close the roof back up or, you know, cover plywood over a broken window. But other than that, it's, you know, fairly routine repair work because there are trees that come down, you know, on a perfectly calm night and cause damage.
Sure. All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take more of your questions and we'll bring in our guests from all these angles as we follow up on the recovery from the storm. The number again is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
They were outside the evacuation zone when the Arkema chemical plant caught fire after Hurricane Harvey. But some residents exposed to the air after the fire say they got hurt.
The first smell that I got smelled like battery acid. Something wrong here.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Did Arkema do enough to protect Texas residents? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Carbon monoxide is a silent, odorless, colorless gas, a deadly killer claiming about 1,000 lives each year in the United States. Often during power outages, the gas can be produced by poorly ventilated generators, gas grills, and other items used for cooking and heating when used improperly during the winter months. So please remember, never run generators indoors or in an attached garage, shed, or crawl space. Keep the generator outside, downwind of your home. Never use charcoal to cook indoors, and never use a gas oven to heat your home. Symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning include sleepiness, headaches, and dizziness. If you suspect carbon monoxide poisoning, ventilate the area and get to a hospital. Stay safe.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, answers to your questions about recovering from the storm. In studio with me, Tom Hedstrom, founder of Hedstrom Electric, located in Camden. On the line with me, Ian Robertson is owner of New Leaf Construction. He'll try and answer some home repair questions you may have. Also on the line with us, Susan Falloon. She's with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. And as always, we invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to go to Tom in a minute, but first we're going to join bring in Andrew Smith. He's the state toxicologist. Andy Smith, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Keith. Delighted to be here.
You heard during the break there some advice about carbon monoxide and avoiding poisoning there. So let's kick it off with that. What is the threat of carbon monoxide, especially during these kinds of storm events?
Well, Keith, let me first start by explaining what carbon monoxide is. It's a gas, and it's colorless, odorless, tasteless, and very dangerous. And it's dangerous because when we breathe it, it displaces oxygen in our blood, deprives the heart, the brain, and other vital organs of oxygen. And so if there's too much oxygen or too much carbon monoxide in the air, it can overcome someone in minutes without warning, causing a loss of consciousness and even death. The more early signs and symptoms of CO poisoning include headache, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, drowsiness, and confusion. So it's certainly something to be very concerned with.
And is this, during these storm events, though, is it linked to portable generators specifically or malfunctions of your furnace?
It's the biggest concern by far is with portable generators. A gasoline-powered portable generator has very high levels of carbon monoxide in their exhaust gases. And in fact, one gas-powered portable generator releases as much carbon monoxide is found in the exhaust of 100 cars.
Mm-hmm. So, but we know, we've heard over and over again, I think we just heard in the last break, to not put these generators in your garage or in your basement. But is that what's still happening?
It's not just about putting them inside, although that obviously is a very dangerous thing to do. I mean, think about it. You wouldn't want 100 cars idling just outside one of your windows or doors, and certainly not inside your garage or shed or barn or even on your porch. So to run a portable generator safely, you need to place it outside in fresh air, more than 15 feet from any doors and windows, and with the exhaust pointing away from the house. You should also have at least one battery-powered carbon monoxide detector or one with a battery backup in your home for added safety protection. I think one of the issues we run into is that when the weather gets wet, like is in the forecast now, people start to make unsafe decisions about where to place the generator, and they're more often going to place them in a garage or a building like that where they're trying to protect them from the elements, not realizing just how much carbon monoxide these generators produce and how dangerous it is.
Sure. Susan Falloon had touched on this secondary issue of food safety, but let's go to that. How long generally does it take for food to go bad after, you know, in a freezer or refrigerator after the power goes out?
Keith, the general rule of thumb is if at any point your perishable food was above 40 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 or more hours, you should discard it.
Okay, but what if you don't either have a thermometer or you may not know when it went out? Is there any other way to tell?
Well, refrigerated food should be safe as long as the power was out for no more than 4 hours. For a lot of us, it's been much longer than that. And you keep the refrigerator door shut. If your power was out for more than 4 hours, then you should discard any perishable food such as meat, poultry, fish, eggs, milk, cream, yogurt, and other dairy products and leftovers. And you need to keep this four-hour time in mind if you are without power and relying on a generator but shutting down the generator at night. You'll need to keep ice blocks or something in the refrigerator to help maintain a safe temperature, and you really should get a thermometer to monitor that temperature. Okay. Let's talk about frozen food and freezers. So a full freezer will hold the temperature for about 48 hours if the doors stay closed, more like 24 hours if it's half full. So once you have power, you need to check each package of food and determine its safety. If the food still contains ice crystals or is 40 degrees or below when you check with a food thermometer, it's safe to refreeze or cook.
Hmm. And do we see a higher incidence of food poisoning in the wake of events like this? What are the symptoms?
We certainly can see increases in food poisoning, and it's something we're monitoring carefully now on a daily basis with our various surveillance systems. The common symptoms of food poisoning include nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. Some symptoms include fever, headache, and body ache. And if you experience any of these symptoms and you suspect food poisoning, you should contact your doctor immediately. You know, these perishable foods that are not kept adequately refrigerated or frozen may cause illness if consumed even when they are thoroughly cooked, and you cannot rely on the appearance or odor. So when in doubt, you've got to throw it out.
All right. Appreciate it very much. Andy Smith is the state toxicologist. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Great. Thank you, Keith.
All right. Tom, I want to turn to you. I know you have to leave soon, but you wanted to bring up a point about surge protectors. Explain what they are and why you think that they're important.
Thanks, Keith. A surge protector is a device that we use primarily to protect electronics. I highly recommend that people use them for all their electronic devices. It's the simple power strip that you often see behind someone's computer or television. They're rated in joules. The higher the joule rating, the better the surge protector. And in the case of a power outage where you might have a voltage spike or a dropped utility ground at the time of a power outage.
So that's at the time of the outage, not when the power comes back on.
You could see it there as well. You could see a voltage variation when the power comes on as well.
So that and that will protect your expensive electronics.
Yes, and not just in the case of a storm. Here in Maine, we have squirrels that cause brownouts. In other events, you know, a rural state with a big grid, it's for $20 or so at your local hardware store. It'll pay for itself at some point.
A sound investment. All right. I want to bring in some callers, too. Jillian in Bucksport has been waiting patiently. Hi, Jillian. Welcome to the program. Give her a chance to join here. Jillian, can you hear me? I do not have Jillian. Let's try Derek in Lewiston. Hi, Derek. Okay, not sure those are coming through. Okay, I guess we're not going to do that. Let me see here. For patience here, if you would indulge me. forgive me, folks. We'll see what's going on with the phone calls coming in. I do have a note on Facebook that I can share with you. Nate Hastings, Assistant Chief of the Holden Fire Department, wants people to stop driving over, touching, or even getting near downed lines. Fire departments get overwhelmed with calls during these events and can't stand by at every one. Even if the grid is down, it's possible for someone's generator to backfeed the wires and cause an electrocution hazard. And we were talking about this during the break. Explain that. What is a generator backfeeding the grid, and what's the danger?
So an illegal installation of a generator is where somebody uses usually a secondary circuit in their circuit breaker panel to backfeed their panel. So rather than using a proper transfer switch that only allows either grid power or generator power, they will hook the generator cable into the circuit breaker panel. If a mistake is made and the main breaker is turned back on that breaker panel, it could put power back to the grid, reverse through the windings on the CMP transformer at the pole.
And that's dangerous.
Dangerous for linemen, dangerous for electricians. The typical high line going down your street is 7,000 plus volts. Electricians don't touch that. That is linemen's only, you know, that work for the utility company. And that's a very dangerous voltage. As the fire chief said, 7,000 volts is a deathly voltage. Stay away from those, particularly those down tie lines.
Okay, Tom, thanks very much. We're going to try to bring in Jillian now, who's calling from Bucksport. Hi, Jillian. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I did hear the response regarding antiquated lines that we have and not putting them underground.
Yes.
I don't actually think that was an acceptable answer. CMP is a business, and if their business doesn't update itself, then, you know, it's really not serving the public, and we're paying for this. Mm-hmm. I think CMP is supposed to update their own systems, not rely on developers in specific areas to do it.
Yes, Gail is not with us anymore on the show, I'm afraid. But I have heard their response and the response of other utilities saying that this is sort of a risk analysis, right? When you look at a storm, this one in this case was second only to the ice storm of 1998. So they're not regular enough to warrant the expense of burying. But Tom, do you have a comment?
There is a national movement to put utility lines underground. Obviously a very expensive thing. It would be on the scale of a New Deal type of, you know, government funding. But it's a good idea.
Yeah, Jillian, you're not alone. This question has been raised and no doubt will be explored further. I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much. I do want to bring in now Randy Klatt, who is he's the director of Loss Control Region 2 with the MEMC Group. Randy, are you with us? Let's see if I can try him now. Randy, can you hear me? Randy Klatt?
Thank you.
Hi, how are you today?
Just great.
I
don't have power at my house either.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, hang in there. You were kind enough to come in and share a few safety tips, specifically around, for example, chainsaw safety. We've been hearing a lot of chainsaws in the neighborhood, obviously, as limbs are being cleared and fallen trees. What is it you want to tell people about this, or warn them, or advise them about?
Right. Well, clearly to us in the safety world, chainsaws are one of the most hazardous tools out there in the toolbox. Obviously, with good training and proper maintenance, it's a tool that can be used and is a great tool for this kind of cleanup. The problem that I'm afraid happens more often than it should, to the tune of about 36,000 people a year going to the emergency room for chainsaw injuries, is that people aren't adequately trained, or they don't use the saw very often and they don't really know how to maintain it. So not unlike your generator that you keep in the shed and pull out once a year when you lose your power, you might pull out the chainsaw once a year. And if it's not properly lubricated, properly sharpened, and there's a lot of detail on how that tool needs to be sharpened to be safe to use, and if you're not wearing the proper protective equipment, and that's head to toe, all the way from hard hat, face protection, ear protection, chaps for your legs, gloves, boots, the whole nine yards. These things are very hazardous, and I'm afraid that the storm is bad enough and losing power and losing trees and damage, but it can be made far worse by someone experienced taking a chance with a chainsaw that they shouldn't. So my word of caution to everyone is, if you're not real familiar with it, let the professionals do it. Let the certified arborists or the tree companies come in and handle those trees. If it's safely in your yard, it'll stay there for a while, and just wait some, and be willing to pay for someone to clean it up if you're not real familiar with the tool.
What if you're just removing some debris that's fallen down, or is there anything to be concerned about or pay attention to?
Well, certainly, a lot of what I see right now are uprooted trees, and so a tree may be partially down. You may think it's safe to cut, and what we're talking about really is a spring pole situation. Or you might have what we call a widow maker, and unfortunately, that's name is for given to it for a reason, where we have suspended branches in a tree, and you're not really aware that they are there. If you clean up a little debris on the ground, you're still using a chainsaw to do it. You need to be very careful with it. If it's a suspended situation, or you have trees in the woods or near your house, but the roots may still be in a ball, partly disrupted from the ground, that's a very, very dangerous situation. As far as basic cleanup goes, I can see the most common injury there that we're going to have is your standard strains and pulls and soft tissue damage from pulling and carrying and lifting and doing those things that maybe you haven't done for a while. And using a chainsaw or working out in the yard, moving that debris, it's hard, hard physical work. And if you're not used to that and you're not careful with it, we're going to see some injuries.
All right, Randy, we're going to have to take a break here, but I really appreciate you sharing those points with us today. Randy Klatt is Director of Loss Control Region 2 with the MEMIC Group. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Stay safe out there.
All right. Hope you get your power back soon. All right, we're going to take a short break. First, a look ahead to tomorrow's show. We'll be talking about proposed rules for regulating the sale and distribution of marijuana. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public.
On the next Fresh Air, how the use of antibiotics in the chicken industry has led to the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The bacteria make their way into our systems in some surprising ways and can lead to infections beyond gastrointestinal ones, including resistant urinary tract infections. We talk with Maren McKenna, author of Big Chicken. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. Today is November 2nd, our original date for our important Super Thursday campaign to ensure the financial support needed to keep your Maine Public Radio service going. Because of the storm earlier this week, we postponed Super Thursday for a week until next Thursday, November 9th. If you've already called in to pledge your support at mainepublic.org, your contribution will be counted toward next week's Super Thursday goals, and thank you. Now, if next Thursday is not convenient for you, you can, of course, always call today at 1-800-866-1475 or pledge online at mainepublic.org. Again, thank you so much. Together, we make this service possible.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, recovering from the storm of 2017, on the line with us, Ian Robertson. He's owner of New Leaf Construction. He'll try and answer any home repair issues you may have in the final moments here. Also with us is Susan Falloon. She's with Maine Emergency Management Agency. And we just said goodbye to Tom Hedstrom. He's founder of Hedstrom Electric, a family-owned company located in Camden. He had an appointment. Thank you, Tom, for joining us. The number 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Frank Kimball. He's with the Property and Casualty Division Director with the Maine Bureau of Insurance. Frank Kimball, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us on.
So what should people do if they have a loss? What's the best way to proceed to get insurance coverage?
Well, the first thing you should do is hopefully you've kept up with your coverage and you do have coverage, because we have had situations where people have, for various reasons, thought they had coverage and they didn't pay their bill or whatever or anything. So that's a preventive thing. But once you do have a loss, you should do two things as simultaneously as you can. One is to contact your insurance company or your insurance agent, put them on notice of the claim so you can get into the queue and they can get somebody to look at your damage as soon as possible. Take some pictures of the damage and take any emergency repairs necessary. For instance, if you have a hole in your roof, you want to put something over it to keep the water from coming in. Emergency repairs such as that.
Sure. So what kinds of calls is your office receiving? What are the kinds of claims that are being asked about more so than others?
I checked with my staff. We've actually only had a couple of calls today. One was, as I had mentioned earlier, somebody who had didn't appear to have coverage because apparently they had somehow had their policy canceled, and there were a lot of circumstances surrounding that, and we're going to be looking into it for that person to see what happened. Mm-hmm. And we did have a call on the food spoilage. Some policies do cover spoilage, some don't, but some are subject to a deductible, some may not be, so you want to make sure that you, again, contact your agent or company, or if you're a really brave soul, read your policy and see if you can figure out if you have coverage for that or not.
Yeah. So, and for things like, a branch through your window, a branch damaging your roof, a tree against the house, is that pretty standard coverage in a typical homeowner's policy?
Yes, most all property policies, commercial and homeowners, would cover falling objects, not wind damage. Not all policies do, but there are very few that do not cover it.
Yeah. Okay. Frank Kimball, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Frank Kimball is Property and Casualty Division Director with the Maine Bureau of Insurance. Ian Robertson, have you done homeowners insurance work?
Yes, we have many times for a number of things.
And how does it work? It generally works pretty smoothly?
Well, just as Frank said, if the insurance company hasn't even become involved when we arrive at the customer's house, we encourage them to take pictures. We typically take a bunch of pictures as we're doing the work so that work can keep moving forward, but yet we're able to show everything that's transpired. And typically it is pretty fluid with the insurance adjusters. They'll come out, they'll talk with the customer. They typically either take our foreman aside or myself or our salesman and say, what have you found? And we'll fill them in, share pictures with them, show them what it took to put it back together, to get it back to where it was. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, most customers are pretty happy with the way they get treated by the insurance company and how they're taken care of.
All right, great. Let's go to Peter in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program. Let's see if we can get
Yes.
Peter.
Yes. Hi. I have a word of praise for CMP and a question.
Okay. Praise accepted on behalf of CMP. And what's your question?
My house is about a tenth of a mile up from the road. And I've always dreaded a storm such as this when my line goes down. And it would take forever for them to get to my line. But they have been proactive in trimming the branches, and not a word. My question is about heating with a cook stove. Why is it different than cooking your turkey for Thanksgiving, which leaves the oven on for hours at a time? With the same gases.
Using a gas stove to heat your kitchen, you mean?
Yeah. No, you're talking about a gas stove. Don't use your oven to heat in an emergency, but you're putting the same gases in the air along with a little fragrance when you cook a turkey for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure we have anyone. Peter, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. I'm not sure we have anyone on the panel who's equipped to answer that question. Susan Falloon?
I can't say as I have a really good answer for that myself. I think it's just that, an oven is not designed to heat a whole room, and that's not what you're trying to do when you're cooking something. You're using it enclosed, and if you're opening it up and running it for an extended period of time, that could certainly pose a safety hazard. Someone could burn themselves, and you could overwork that unit as well. So it just that was not what they were designed to do.
All right. Thank Peter. Thank you for your question. I'm happy that your power is back on. Let's go to Derek in Lewiston. Hi, Derek. Oh, we lost Derek. Let's go to Susie, are you in Montville?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you get me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, good. Well, I have a little bit of a different type of comment. I do want to say I understand people are focusing on security and people being safe, and I completely understand that. But I think we also have to be thinking about the future and what's happening climactically. And I live off the grid. I have sailed through. I didn't even really know what was happening except that there was a couple trees down in the yard. I understand that most people aren't going to live off the grid, but I have a friend who has a big solar system at her house. She's tied into the grid, and what she's been waiting for is her Tesla wall so that when these things happen, she can actually continue to run her solar system and have electricity while she's waiting for the grid to come back on. So what I propose is that we actually start to really invest in solar energy. If we made real advances in supporting solar systems and solar technology, people could have solar on pretty much every building in Maine. It could feed into the grid on a day-to-day basis. And when we have emergencies, we could have little battery backup systems. It doesn't have to meet all your needs. Just keep your house warm, keep your heat system going if you're not heating with wood. Keep your electricity going and your food healthy, and then feed back into that system once it's gone. And you can still have a little backup generator. I have a backup generator too, but it's amazing how well solar systems actually work. I haven't had much sun since Sunday. I have a very small system, and I haven't even had to turn my generator on yet.
Yeah. So and that's enough to power, though. Do you have a freezer, for example?
Yeah, I have a small freezer, and now I have a very small system. And people could have, most people have much more ample systems than I have. But it runs my entire house. It I'm not a big consumer, right? I don't have a big TV and things like that. But I have 8 panels. I'm so bad at this. I believe it's less than I think the right thing is kilowatt. I'm a Luddite. It just works. I've had it for 15 years, and it's fabulous. I run all my technology. I run all my electricity. I run my water pump. Everything works.
All right. Yeah. Susie, thanks so much. I'm glad it worked for you, and we appreciate you calling the show today. Ian Robertson, what's your experience as in your business of construction? Are you seeing more solar installations and or buildings that are designed to accommodate solar in your business?
I would say that I guess just in terms of normal driving around in our community, I do see a small handful of houses that are being outfitted with solar panels. We've had one customer in particular that set it up through Revision Energy. His house is down in South Thomaston.
Mm. I'm just wondering, in the wake of these storms, does interest in solar increase for builders or for energy businesses?
I certainly haven't picked up on that as a specific reason to go in a solar direction. I guess I couldn't really speak to the community's thoughts on that. Sure. Maybe some, I'm fairly ignorant as to how beneficial they are during storm weather or during days of inclement weather as to just how much power they can provide. But.
Sure. Susan Falloon, Maine Emergency Management Agency, I'm sure you, as a planning entity, you will look at this storm and how you responded or how other entities responded and make adjustments for future storms or future emergencies. How does that process work? Do you use this? Do you take advantage of this as a way to improve the way that the state responds to future emergencies?
We absolutely do, and we'll do an after-action review. We plan exercises, and in fact, we have been exercising an ice storm scenario over the last year, and we just wrapped that up last week, and that really helped us respond to this storm in a much more efficient manner because we had already updated plans. We had already updated our communications contact lists. We had already gotten all the players into the State Emergency Operations Center so they knew what their role was. And so it's almost like we picked right up where the exercise left off and we started running with this scenario. And we've had the utility folks, representatives here in the State Emergency Operations Center, or at least on the phone. So, I mean, we have improved our processes immensely since the ice storm of 98, and that's, you know, kind of been the storm that we have compared all other storms against, at least until now. And so now we'll continue to look at, you know, we're already making lists of, hey, we need to think about this, we need to think about this. And we have so many more people sitting in the State Emergency Operations Center and having those conversations now and working through those things, and then we will implement changes as we go. And it's an ongoing process. I mean, we've seen this play out with the hurricanes nationwide, the earthquakes, the wildfires. And, you know, when I am finally able to get together with other state emergency management agencies and meet, because that had to get postponed because of all the national disasters, we are all going to discuss our lessons learned.
And are you anticipating, this is a big question, but we all hear talk of, you know, how we anticipate more and more powerful storms in future. We can debate that, but do you as an entity fold that into your future planning?
Well, we certainly gear up for the absolute worst case scenario, and that's what we did when we did our ice storm scenario, and then we threw in a solar issue as well that only made that problem worse, and we tried to think of the worst possible scenario. And, you know, we've had some of our partner agencies say that the scenario that we came up with that we thought would never ever happen paled in comparison to what actually happened this week. And so, you know, with that said, and we look at how quickly hundreds of thousands of utility customers had power restored, the response has been amazing. And so, you know, we're always looking to make improvements. We're never going to stop trying to improve that process. That is why we exist.
All right, Susan Falloon, thank you very much for joining us today. Susan Falloon with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. Also, thanks to Ian Robertson, owner of New Leaf Construction. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And thanks also to Tom Hedstrom, founder of Hedstrom Electric in Camden. He had to leave us earlier. George Thomas ran the board today, and we had technical help from John Keimel, Nick Godfrey, Roddy Nickpour, Rich Tozier, and Gil Maxwell. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about proposed regulations for the sale and distribution of marijuana. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.